Introduction. Dare to Win. If man will only realize that it is unmanly to obey laws that are unjust, no man's tyranny will enslave him. This is the key to self-rule or home rule. Gandhi, from his pivotal work, Hind Swaraj, Indian Self-Rule or Home Rule, Gandhi 1910, p. 92. One vote away, the extinction of free thought or the blossoming of real democracy. It's down to you, to me, to us. This book is not a formal intelligence report, but it does reflect the know-how gained over 16 years as an officer in the British Army's Intelligence Corps and broad experience since 1997 in many countries in commercial, corporate, entrepreneurial, and low-skilled tasks, variety being the spice of life. What follows is a warning based on half a century of analyzing totalitarian threats and dealing with them in uniform, out of it, paid and unpaid. The object here is to secure your support for what I believe to be the best system of self-rule that any democracy can operate under, that being a hybrid democracy that incorporates vital elements of both representative and direct democracy. I see no comparably proven or effective system that can halt our slide towards our subjugation in a variety of semi and fully totalitarian states, and ultimately to stop us from tumbling into the abyss of a global authoritarian regime. Such an unacceptable system is defined by a politicizing of all types of activity and the refusal to permit the existence, let alone the flourishing, of any activity not in conformity with the political goals of the state. Mankiewicz, 1973, p. 234. No fun allowed. That's subversive. This nightmare sounds a lot closer now than it was only a few years ago, doesn't it? My assessment of the current situation is that democracy confronts two significant groups threatening such an outcome, robbing us of our freedoms and destroying our democracies. They are masters of manipulation, obfuscation, and denial, and they set the agendas, write the narratives, control the media, and enact the laws. These forces are most simply represented as money and Marx. Money. The most immediate and major threat comes from the globalist urges of the central banking elite, for the most part led by New York Fed financiers, the U.S. military-industrial complex. Yes, President Eisenhower warned us of its existence in his farewell address in 1961, Eisenhower 1961, the administrative apparatus soaking up ever greater funds and freedoms, and financial and corporate networks around the world. Hamburger, 2020. These aim at their supremacy and the imposition of their will through covert and overt manipulation of events, control over policy, and direction of the media and education systems. The New World Order, yes, aspired to by our moneyed wannabe emperors, is why you see events being spun in the press to advance globalization and to crush nations, which are our best hope for the future through greater localization. The U.S. money madmen dream up the big picture ideas, then largely rely upon their tax-exempt foundation fronts to come up with arguments on which to build narratives suiting their aims. This is particularly so for the largest and most venerable of the elite's institutions, the Carnegie, Rockefeller, and Ford foundations, the Big Three. The inspiration for the major strategic aims of these institutions aligns with those of Britain's most significant Victorian-era imperialist, Cecil Rhodes. His plans for an Anglo-American elite-run world, achieved through the activities of a secret society, were all openly discussed in journals and books before and after his passing away in 1902. As the head of the Department of International Politics at City University of London, Inderjeet Parmar has spent decades studying the foundations and their activities, concluding, "Oh, in short, the foundations were created and led by self-conscious progressive-era state builders, private citizens who backed state power for globalist ends. Today, they are self-conscious global civil society builders. Palmer, 2014, p. 6. Oh, domestically, the big foundations sponsored a vast range of programs that, inter alia, transformed the American Academy, sustained an array of foreign policy think tanks and vigorous foreign affairs media coverage. Foundation leaders, in effect, helped to create and perpetuate elite networks of academics, think tanks, public organizations, emerging mass media, and public officials. These networks proved powerful in constructing and mobilizing a globalist elite and broader support in the United States, a nation renowned for its strongly isolationist tendencies on the political left and right. Palmer, 2014, p. 7. Overseas, the foundations were active in network building and perhaps even more influential, especially in the areas of political and economic development, in promoting capitalist modernization. Such networks were established in strategically important countries and regions, such as Indonesia, Chile, and Nigeria, specifically to ensure a regional and continental multiplier effect. Palmer, 2014, p. 7. The power and depth of the influence of these groups will become obvious as you work through this book. Their activities lie at the heart of the globalization underway today, and two of the three have been well-funded for over a century. This is not a conspiracy theory, it is a strategy being implemented by like-minded power elite groups, with the foundations leading the drive. Tragically, as Palmer found, the Foundation's globalist aims are not necessarily the ones publicly stated. Palmer, 2014, p. 11. Private elites played key roles in the making of foreign policy, opinion mobilization, and overseas policy implementation with the direct and indirect support of the American state. Indeed, foundations and think tanks often were able to operate under the fiction that they were independent non-state institutions in sensitive countries and regions. Palmer, 2014, p. 24. One of the opinion mobilizing institutes he refers to above is Yale, the outcome of their input being their support for permanent war on a global scale. Here is Yale's contribution to U.S. grand strategy. Palmer, 2014, p. 71. One intellectual who had a profound effect on American progressive intellectuals in the early part of the 20th century was the science fiction writer H.G. Wells. This Fabian one-worlder was also the author of New World Order and The Open Conspiracy, both of which lay out many of the aspirations that the magnates have adopted. You think this unlikely? New World Order was one of the 18 advisory texts used for the drafting of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. More recently, one of our leading lawyers in the human rights field stated that in the 20th century, Wells was the main influence on the drafting of human rights conventions and laws. Gentry, Kynan, Mason, Victoria, 2019. Wells, like a lot of leading Western intellectuals in the late Victorian years and the early 20th century, was also a eugenicist and racist, an odd proponent for human rights, don't you think? But maybe not if you dreamed of a socialist world state, Wells, 1969, PC 780, as the best destiny for us. All will become clear. So, the intellectual heft for the new order elite usually comes from outside of the moneyed circles, but where the ideas suit their purposes, these can be profitably used to justify the actions they take. All for our good, of course. Thomas, 1996, p. 13. The obvious globalist power grab that we see underway now follows on from the battles the East Coast U.S. elite had with the isolationist and nationalist forces they opposed on their home turf. However, the reason for the current madness is that they have had to rapidly react to events as their control freak narrative is being increasingly revealed and understood. In the late 1940s, Whittaker Chambers turned away from communism and his role as a Soviet agent. He did a great deal to open the eyes of the world to the penetration of the US government by Soviet spies and fellow travelers. Most importantly, he identified the chief aim of all such conspiratorial groups. That power to influence policy has always been the ultimate purpose of the Communist Party's infiltration. It was much more dangerous and, as events have proved, much more difficult to detect than espionage, which besides it is trivial, though the two go hand in hand. Chambers, 1980. It's the policy, stupid. All else follows from that, as any Chinese communist will tell you. Fortunately for us, the internet has opened many minds to realities previously hidden or obscured, forcing the interest manipulators to flood media channels that they own or control with ever more news. They are doing whatever they can to drown out awkward questions and to damp down any coherent response to their assault on the liberty of the individual. The power elite is a tiny group of uber-rich and super-connected finance and business magnates with a few state actors representing nothing like 1% of the population, in fact, only a tiny fraction of a percent. These are the agenda setters at the United Nations, UN, the World Economic Forum, WEF, and other globalist get-togethers around the world, not the gophers in the cheap seats being given their marching orders. These few priority makers wield their billions, finance their foundations with their crucial, misunderstood, and little reported influence, and mobilize the major finance houses and nation states as the means to push us into conforming to their wills. If you are just some random multimillionaire or state or corporate bigwig tagging along in support, you are just a handy tool for the big guns. It may be that you are as unaware of their real plans and motivations as are most of the 99.99%, but if you are aware and playing your part, then you are as arrogant, sick, and deluded as they are. Now, if you think that in addressing the threat that the central banking types represent, that numbers count, that the people can deal with this, you are right. However, they can only do so when they are aware. Right now, not enough are, and thus cannot give their informed consent to alternatives. Genghis Khan demonstrated how a few can conquer and rule the many, crushing the Qin Empire in the 5 years between 1211 and 1216, reputedly subjugating 100 million Chinese with just 100,000 warrior horsemen from the steppe. Kash, 2006, p. 85. The handful of money raiders are trying to do much better, restricting and controlling billions through sponsored representatives awash with their contributions who are marching in step with their allies in compliant authoritarian regimes. Yes, that is why Prime Minister Liz Truss was forced out when she offered up an economic program not aligned with the central banker's vision, stepping outside the parameters set by the finagling financiers. I also suspect that the original religious impetus that drove the likes of the Rockefellers has diminished, which detracts from the focus and coherence of their efforts. And this partially explains why things are unraveling so disastrously now. In addition, the money-mad oddballs are closer to Marx than most realize, as their world also centers on economy and class, not putting much, if any, emphasis on the many other lenses through which life can be viewed. And just as Marx's aim of a dictatorship of proletarians promises centralization, terror, and totalitarianism, that of the financier rhymes with it. The financial world is more than happy to favor the large over the small, the corporate over the competitive. Hence, our heading for fascist state capitalism, with the favored few deciding when we need to be jabbed, corralled, and subdued. As Michael Hudson warns us, neoliberalism presents itself as a free market opposition to centralized planning, but its aim is precisely to use control of credit to concentrate resource allocation in the hands of the major financial centers. There is still big government, but its role is to protect the wealth of the 1% from public regulation and taxation of rentier income, not to raise prosperity for the economy at large. The financial sector's aim is to promote rentier oligarchies in which bankers play the dominant role, wielding their wealth to control national politics, much as landed aristocracies did down through the 19th century. Hudson, 2022, pp. 255, 256. These are odd times when someone like me agrees with the logic of a left-wing economist's arguments, but this is where we are. We already have seen humor in lockdown and freedoms dissolve, the early warning signs of what is to come, if we continue to bend to their will. And who benefits most from this myopic economic focus? Marx. The Communist Manifesto gifted us the Soviet gulags and Mao's miserable murder machine, the Chinese Communist Party, CCP. This genocidal bunch already sports a death count of over 60 million and threatens our fellow democracy lovers in Taiwan with invasion. The canny communists, fanboys of Sun Tzu, are not our friends, they are our deadly enemies. In the West, those supporting the culling-prone Marxists and the spin-off franchises inspired by the bearded sponge's sick vision of a dictatorship run by a tiny vanguard have been busy carrying out their long and successful march through many of our institutions. They have secured powerful and covert influence in many of the United States' administrative functions, particularly in the political, legal, and educational fields, and they are busy burrowing their way into institutions around the globe, and quite effectively, too. As Whittaker Chambers intimated above, this core communist activity has been underway for over a century, with covertly introduced speech codes being a relatively recent marker of their success. However, even these recent festering sores can be traced back to the early 1980s, becoming widespread on U.S. campuses by the late 1990s, as reported in The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses. Cause, Alan Charles, Silverglate, Harvey A., 1999, p. 6. Never forget, Marxists and their fellows believe that lies, dissimulation, and disinformation are weapons to be used without remorse in their battle for supremacy over those who don't accept their vision. The very aim of communism, a dictatorship of the proletariat, indicates why we should trust no Western politician buddying up to the CCP. I think that the word dictatorship is clue enough, don't you? This is not fake news, it's not an exaggeration. It's an ex-intelligence officer's assessment based on almost 50 years of experience studying these psychopaths, sociopaths, and the misinformed unfortunates that these masters of manipulation routinely mislead. As Gandhi said, we must rule ourselves and not allow any of the elites with these global totalitarian ideologies to impose their will. Nation-states are still the most effective and legitimate means to defend our freedoms and our cultures, whilst the various utopian visions of globalist elites are just a sick desire to control others. All they are trying to do is to force us to adopt, espouse, and demonstrate the beliefs and behaviors that they wish us to. As Hans Kohn clearly shows us in Nationalism and Liberty, the Swiss example, Kohn, 1956 nationalism, is not Nazism, that it can allow greater localization and tolerance whilst fostering genuine consent and the growth of the people through direct involvement in policy formulation. The devolution of power to Canton and even lower community levels in Switzerland has given the nation 26 education systems, but even the WEF recognizes the national result of this localization as the best education system in the world. Well, competition is good, no? And local people deciding for themselves to maintain diversity is also good, is it not? The Swiss demonstrate that nationalism based on localization can be used to build unity more effectively than any empire builder, globalist, or genocidal totalitarian has ever been able to. Not only that, single nations have recently been formed out of states which split peacefully, such as Czechoslovakia in 1992. And why not? The alternative, globalism, the melding of peoples, religions, civilizations, cultures, nations, and societies has a poor record in history, so where does that leave us? South Sudan was created because of the genocidal activities of the Arab Northerners, demonstrating that disparate groups that have deep-seated animosities may require separation to ensure a peaceful and long-term resolution. That is just a fact of life, at least for now. If the UN Secretary-General can explain how a global state will better the position of the South Sudanese, I am sure they will be all ears. This book is a realist's assessment of the near future and a plan to see it develop on peaceful lines, with freedom spreading as nations decide for themselves how they wish to live, unforced by cloistered, arrogant, and dangerous know-betters who do not appear to have studied much history, let alone learned objective lessons from it. Without the people controlling their own destinies, these elitist true believers will continually restrict our freedoms, offering no reasons or arguments capable of convincing us to support their lofty aims, so they simply try to rule over us. George Orwell warned us about such thinkers, and in this book, I lay out what I believe to be the best weapon for our defense: nations submitting to voter control. I have spent much of the past half century gathering the means to combat the totalitarian urge, and for decades have worked with others to counter them. I now work with the recently formed Direct Democracy Movement, and we are working with others to deploy the Block Vote Direct Democracy voting platform that allows users to take part in votes on issues that truly interest voters. The aim is to demonstrate a system more secure and effective than government platforms, highlighting the benefits of direct democracy. It also provides an example of what could become an integral part of the hybrid democracies we must build in the future if we are to remain free and equal. Such a hybrid system has been evolving since elements of direct democracy were first adopted at the national level by a modern nation in Switzerland in 1848. It has proved hugely successful by most measures, including in its ability to draw factions together. Hans Kohn, whose work I noted earlier, was a European Jew who fought for the Austro-Hungarian Empire in World War I, eventually becoming a professor in the US. He pioneered the academic study of nationalism and was a constant critic of it. Obituary, 1971. However, for the hybrid democratic system which Switzerland uses, he had only praise, writing a whole book to provide his analysis of this singular nation, nationalism and liberty, the Swiss example. Kohn, 1956. In it, he argued that the hybrid system had succeeded in establishing harmony and cooperation among the various linguistic and religious groups, and, most interestingly, that Switzerland could serve as a model for Europe. It seems that the new breed of European Union empire builders might have benefited from his 1956 book's guidance, but there again, the politicians would have been hobbled, their vanity constrained, and the cash cow's purse strings held too tightly by the voters. In more real politic terms, the US policy drivers noted above wanted to have a single European entity as a bulwark against the Soviets to end Europe's internecine wars and as a market for the power elite's goods. I think that it is worth pointing out that my support for democracy and my expectations of its growth and improvement has been almost lifelong. It is often forgotten that democracy has been spreading around the globe for many decades. The process is not smooth, ideal, or complete, but the curve is upwards. In the 1970s, South America had hardly any representative democracies, but had many military regimes and authoritarian governments. This is no longer the case, and the same was true of Asia and Africa. And when I was young, the military governed Greece, Spain, and Portugal. These changes are not celebrated as much as they should be, but they are facts, not fake news. More importantly, these are not only changes in ways of governing, they bring with them different ways of thinking. They foster greater aspirations and expectations, and these spill over borders to those living in adjoining authoritarian regimes as well. This is why I believe that as people wake up in the representative democracies to the con trick that they are, the hybrid will triumph. Of this, I am sure. Then China, watch out. I ask that those of you willing to defend freedom and democracy to do so now. No system, empire, or organism is protected from extinction, but man is gifted with a brain capable of decision-making that can reduce the chances of democracy deteriorating and dying. However, we have to act and, if necessary, struggle peacefully but effectively for how we are going to continue living together in tolerant societies, because selection is, for various reasons, appallingly often unable to prevent extinction. Mayer, 1992, PA 164. Whether a concerned member of the public, a politician, a lawyer, or formerly in the military, we must stand, demand, and win the people's veto over those aiming at our subjugation. We cannot lie down in pathetic obeisance to the overseers of a sick financial oligarchy, murderous Marxists, or totalitarian theocrats. With courage, we are one vote away from controlling our destiny. When you take a holistic view of the per capita success of nations around the world, the democracies take the honors, but among them, who carries away the prize? It's not a simple representative democracy in which the elite make the decisions. It is the semi-representative, semi-direct hybrid of Switzerland. In nature, single-parent organisms do exist, but are rare and more prone to rapid extinction than those born to two parents. Mayer, 1992, p. 123. This Darwinian observation lends support to my argument that the reason that the Swiss hybrid is so robust and so popular with its own citizens is because their system combines the benefits of both representative and direct democracy with the strength in one, buttressing any weakness in the other. I believe that this hybrid democracy provides the best and most realistic future for all of us. It still offers choices in the parties we can support, whilst allowing us to bring legislators to heel through wielding the people's veto if they offer up draft laws that are unpopular. This veto need not be used willy-nilly, as a requirement could be mandated for the gathering of a reasonable number of signatures in a set time period to support the call for a referendum. However, events are proving that it is necessary and that it is the only way we can rapidly control a representative body. It allows us to be the guardians watching over our demonstrably corrupt and self-serving elected caretakers, as Dicey noted. This final quality check by the electorate is the vital ingredient, the rare metal dropped into the political smelter that can turn legislative pig iron into our nation's armor plate. In this argument for national freedom and the creation of tolerant and robust hybrid democracies, I offer some how-to guidance and practical suggestions, further leavened with personal stories chosen to illustrate my points, all aiming to ensure that we succeed in this noble cause. In my research over the years, I read thousands of books and came to focus on a few specific texts that best demonstrate the issues I cover and the lessons I learned from my studies. I have come to realize that the outstanding moment of my lifetime occurred back in 1961. On the 17th of January of that year, President Dwight D. Eisenhower gave what may be the most important speech in U.S. history, his farewell address. In this, he warned us about the military-industrial complex and the scientific, administrative, and bureaucratic elites, capture of the state's political apparatus, intimating that they had already begun gorging on the power and taxes of the federal government. Coming to understand what he was trying to warn us about is central to this book and our lives. Unfortunately, the utopian ideals of the power-hungry almost always include plans for the removal of those who do not fit into their nightmarish, idealized state. Just as the utopias they envision differ, so do the origins of the power elite groupings. As new species tend to develop more often in differing environments and biogeographies, the same is true for the magnates and the Marxists. The power elite from the rarefied upper echelons of the New York corporate and banker crowd have come to dominate formal global organizations, and the Marxists from conspiratorial national groups from within the academy and other disparate elements have been busy taking over our institutions. It is time for the majority, the targets of these tiny alliances, to deal with the threats they represent and to impose democracy in its best proven form. It's time for us to awaken from our slumbers and to use our numbers to see them off, sending them back to the shadows from which they slithered. I understand that we are very fallible and imperfect beings, which is why we are in our current crises. Nevertheless, I do believe that this change to our democratic system can significantly improve life for all of us. However, to bring this about, we must overcome our determined foes in the entitled elites. This book reveals the means by which most of us can shuffle these wily operators off the stage to become the supporting cast, allowing us, not representatives, to have the final say over the laws we live under. Only by doing this, ensuring that the will of the people trumps that of the corruptible parties and our manipulative masters, can we be truly free at last. Right now, we are teetering one vote away from true democracy or a global gulag. In the past, individuals and like-minded groups gained power in their tribes by offering leadership over their spiritual and social concerns. The stronger and more capable the leaders, the more likely it became that the new structure would survive and its officers would retain control. Naturally, over time, those in positions of power came to expect as their due the status and material rewards that came with their roles, and many saw their pliant supporters as inferior to themselves. Even within the elite, a tighter group of decision-makers would separate off from others within the circle of power, with these agenda-setters using the gophers, go for this, go for that, to enforce and administer their control over the masses. The history of civilization in all parts of the globe is basically the story of the rise of these elites to political power over us. At first, their climb was just a local issue, but as the world has grown more interconnected, regional and global organizations have proliferated. The scramble for the very top has continued, but with ever greater spans of control. Whilst Napoleon complex individuals are famously found in sanatoriums, many appear to haunt the corridors of power to ensure that policies and regulations created by bureaucrats favor their vision. Sadly, the higher they climb, the more dangerous they become, with greater authority and a growing number of people that they can adversely affect. The natural propensity of most people to respect authority has also been intentionally magnified within education systems, and this tendency to obey is further strengthened by the propaganda apparatus available to the power brokers through the public relations, PR, industry that they disproportionately own and utilize. Ever since its inception, PR has been weaponized and its products pumped out on behalf of our controllers. It gets worse. The accountability of those in authority has not only been reduced, liability has even been eliminated in the largest and most dangerous medical experiment in global history. The study of elites is sometimes a part of college courses, but this is not an academic work, it's a briefing pack and a getting things done manual, aimed at seeing that the majority of us work together as individual voters to control the elites. In so doing, we can put the interests of the many first and those of the power monopolists second. I am hoping that this simple aim will work where complex utopian waffle has not. An important point to keep in mind is that some elite groups are much more consequential than others because they have strategic and global aims. Other less powerful groups have interests that are more tactical or local, but they can still play a role in imposing the will of the global players. Whilst most may operate openly, a desire to hide their true objectives is not uncommon, even from each other. The magnates and the Marxists do have diverse aims, and there are enough conflicting interests to ensure that there is no single controller or master manipulator, but as we are seeing, their interests and actions may align. As I will show, the study of strategy has matured and allowed it to be more refined than in the past, and its implementation is better understood and more capably applied, with mass psychology being one obvious and massively overused element. This ensures that the various elites at their UN, WEF, and Bilderberg soirees can develop more complex but integrated plans, particularly as these groups now meet more frequently and thus have grown closer. Today, after Brexit, Trump and the WUFLU totalitarians attempted insurrection against the people, battle is joined by the globalist utopians and local peoples around the globe. Those in elite circles can benefit fantastically from being part of the network, with some born into the system, whilst others climb the corporate and status ladders to enter it. Rarely in history has a people been able to put a stop to this behavior, so the drift into dictatorship and authoritarianism has continued, often for centuries, before the put-upon managed to toss out the anchor and stop the ship of state running ashore. This book tells you how to take the helm, turn the vessel around, and head for where the people wanted to go in the first place.